Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters.
Hello, at a pivotal moment in Chapter 17 of Nathaniel Hawthorne's House of the Seven Gables, two of his protagonists escape from haunted Salem, Massachusetts, and are magicked away from its power by the miracle of the railroad. Looking from the window, they could see the world racing past them. At one moment, they were rattling through a solitude. The next, a village had grown up around them. A few breaths more and had vanished, as if swallowed by an earthquake. The spires of meeting houses seemed set adrift from their foundations. The broad-based hills glided away. Everything was unfixed from its age-long rest and moving at whirlwind speed in a direction opposite to their own. As in Hawthorne, American literature of all kinds quickly abounded with railroads and steam power metaphors. In an incredibly short time, a new technology became a point of common reference for an entire nation. In 1860, when Sally McNeill first saw a train in Brazoria County, Texas, she noted in her diary that I could hardly realize this was my first sight of the iron horse because I have read and heard of the cars so often that everything seemed natural. With me to discuss steamboats, railroads, and steam engines and their cultural and social power in the antebellum United States is Aaron W. Mars, author of The American Transportation Revolution, A Social and Cultural History. Aaron W. Mars is a historian at the Department of State. I should announce here that his views on steamboats, railroads, steam engines, and related topics are his own and not those of the State Department or of the United States government. Aaron Mars, welcome to Historically Thinking.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that kind introduction.
You begin by arguing that transportation's developments from 1830 to 1860 were different than other technological innovations that Americans experienced, either before that time or since that time. Could you give some of the lineaments of your argument?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take those in reverse order. In terms of the time afterward, there is a very robust literature on the history of technology, transportation specifically in the postbellum era. A lot of wonderful authors have tackled this topic. And I think in that time period, it is much easier to talk about mass culture. And so a number of authors have done that really, really well. But there's been less exploration of what was going on prior to the Civil War. So in terms of the change before the Civil War, Americans had had a lot of contact with the products of steam-powered manufacturing. So they read newspapers, they read books, they bought clothes, all of which were using these new technologies for production. What was different with the transportation is the level of direct contact that ordinary Americans had with the steam engine. So you could read a newspaper without ever seeing a printing press, or you could put on a coat without ever seeing the factory that manufactured it. But with transportation, you're actually putting your body inside the machine. You're delivering yourself into the power of this new technology and the people running it. So it's a much more, it's a more intimate relationship. And of course, compared to how transportation happened before the introduction of steam, there's a different scale in terms of potential danger. When you're walking, you could fall down. When you're on a horse, the horse could throw you. If you're in a canoe, the canoe could tip over. But steamboat and railroad accidents were more dangerous, larger scale, involved many more people. And so there were a lot of changes happening around this new technology.
So I guess the thing that has always struck me, and we're not going to be talking about the telegraph, which for reasons we won't get into here, sort of parallels the development of the railroad. But the awesome speed, which Hawthorne alludes to or describes in that passage from House of the Seven Gables, the speed that you experience is such a step up over anything that we were used to before. So what, we could walk at like 4 miles an hour. You could ride really fast at what, 20 miles an hour. And all of a sudden you can actually double the speed of a racehorse. And maybe even triple the speed of a racehorse. That's an extraordinary advance. It would be like we now fly to Europe at say 600 miles an hour. That would be like, in 5 years, 10 years from now, we all become used to traveling at what, 1800 miles an hour, which, seems improbable to say the least. So that alone, and then of course the rapid adoption that I alluded to. I was trying to think about how this parallels the computer. Mm. And I think the computer was around a lot longer before people actually got to play with one. It was more slowly adopted than even steam power.
Yeah. And I'm not an expert in the history of computing, but my general sense has always been that they had been around for a long time before certainly you and I had them on our desktops, or let alone in our pockets. Certainly, mm-hmm. I'm old enough to remember initially typing papers on a typewriter and then, moving on to an Apple II computer that had no hard drive. Now I'm talking to you on my desktop computer, more powerful than anything I could have imagined back then. So that's a transition that's happened during my lifetime. As you alluded, the movement and the adoption of steam transit was very quick. I think a couple of reasons for that. One, it's, by design, it's something that is sort of out there in the public for people to use. And so steamboats and railroads they needed customers, they needed merchandise to ship, they needed passengers. And so it was always going to be looking for outlets that would allow people to use it. Second of all, the advantages of steam transit over, walking, riding a horse, going in a slower boat were immediately apparent. One of the striking things to me when I was doing the research was how metaphors about speed permeated not just, printed material like newspapers among, commentators at the time, but you can find them in just the letters of regular people. Life is moving at quote unquote railroad speed. And so a lot of people immediately grasp the advantages of this type of transportation. When railroads break ground in the 1830s and 40s, there are celebrations, there are huge parades. Groups will take a barrel of water from one end of a railroad route and carry it to the other end to dump it out to sort of symbolize connection. So these are huge public events. People are very excited. Something that they eagerly adopted because I think the benefits were readily apparent.
Before we get to some of this, the way that to the sort of the rest of your book and to some of the chapters in your book and the argument as you lay it out in your book, let me ask you a terrible question. Part of this is the effect of steam power on society, but also culture. What is culture?
What is culture? In the context of what I'm writing, for me, culture is two things. First, it's a set of practices or expectations. How do people behave when they're in certain situations? And what we see is that on steamboats and railroads, steam transit generally, there is a culture of how you should behave when you get on board. Who do you talk to? Who do you sit next to? What happens to your seat when you vacate it? What do you do with luggage? you know, all sorts of things that I'm sure we can get into later if you like. And so that's one way that culture operates in this book, is sort of a set of expectations or practices. On a slightly larger scale, culture is also a series of products that we consume. It's novels, it's songs, it's jokes, it's sermons, all kinds of things. And these larger products of culture, it's an example of where steam transit quickly wormed its way into all different aspects of American life. And so a good deal of what I spend time doing in the book is charting these different cultural products and seeing how steam transit had an impact on them, not just in their distribution. Steam transit obviously makes it a lot easier for books to be, or other printer products to be distributed, but also it demonstrates how Americans reacted to this development in technology. So they didn't just board a train and see it as a convenient way to get from one place to another, but they wrote songs about it. They wrote poetry. They wrote jokes. They drew cartoons. Steam transit appears on currency, being political cartoons. It's sort of all over the place. And so those two different aspects of culture, one is a set of expectations, and two as a series of products that people consume. Those are the main ways that I talk about culture in this book.
So you begin the book by looking at how steam power, the steam revolution, steam transit, all these things, begins to change political culture. It changes the relationship between local and state communities and with each other and with corporations. And actually, it changes, it alters the relationship between local and state communities. And I guess really we can trace this all the way. This is this continuing, eventually more so with railroads and with steamboat lines. But this the way that steam power and steam transit affects local and state governments and eventually the federal government will eventually transition to progressive politics. But in the 1830s, 1840s, how is the steam revolution changing these governmental relationships?
Yeah, well, as you alluded, this is a bit more the case for railroads than it is for steamboats, because railroads need space in which to operate. Steamboats are, for the most part, going along existing waterways. So those things are already established. But for a railroad to be constructed, land that was initially for one purpose has to be repurposed for that. And so these relationships revolve around a few different things. One is just securing permission in order to do that. So corporations had to go out and talk to individual landowners. If they're out in a rural area, to try to string together, piece together the puzzle that would allow them to get the route that they wanted. For towns, railroad companies had to often get permission if they wanted to go into certain parts of a town, or if they wanted to operate at different hours of the day, if they wanted to be able to sound their whistle. There were sort of noise ordinances come into play here. And so corporations had to negotiate with a lot of different players in order to be able to construct. And obviously that's something that changes over time. So in the 1850s, it looks different than it does in the 1830s because people are more accustomed to this. They understand, if we allow this construction to take place, we're going to realize certain benefits. But at the same time, they've also seen how there can be some downsides to this sort of construction. Railroads, if they stop in your town, that's great. If you're a terminus, you get all the business, your money, you know, the farmers bring in goods to sell, and that helps increase business for your town. But if a railroad decides to keep on going, then your town goes from being in an important terminus or endpoint to just another way station. There is a lot of sort of give and take in the antebellum period as people sort of look at the advantages and disadvantages and calculate what's going to be best for their area. And so the corporations, cities, towns, individual landowners all have to negotiate this throughout the entire period.
Let's talk about the new experience of travel, and this applies to both in different ways to both steamboats and to railroads. And the first, and these are things that we now take absolutely for granted, but just a few minutes thought of reading your book, you realize this is all brought about because of steam power. We'll gallop through them or steam through them relatively quickly. The first would be regularity. How is that a new thing?
Yeah. So railroads offered the promise of regularized travel. If you were just out, walking or on your horse, you were not bound by a schedule. But that also means that there wasn't any particular guarantee of when you would show up. And so what steam transit promised was giving a schedule and a regularity to transit. One of the chief reasons for this was because in the time, this is sort of pre-telegraph, time management was the chief safety consideration for a railroad. Most of these railroads are single track, and so traffic is moving in both directions on the same set of rails. And you can do that, but if you're going to do that, you need to make exactly sure where the trains are going to be so that they're not running into each other, trying to use the same part of the track at the same time. And so time management was really, really important for the safety of early railroads. And so because of that, these schedules become absolutely necessary and something that people can depend on. And so railroads end up helping educate the broader public about the importance of time management, because if you come a minute late, you're essentially an hour late or 3 hours late. It's all the same. You can't yell after them and ask them to wait up or run after them and join in. You've missed it, period.
And this is, I guess, part of the technology that is not steam powered, but we take for granted is the rail. The rail is fantastic compared to every other road in America. You can be so much more regular with a train because of the rails, because you're not on corduroy roads made of logs. You're not going through mud pits. The rail enables regularity.
It does. And it, trains need a smooth, level, well-drained surface in order to operate. And so the companies had to construct those. You think a little bit about unintended consequences. There are plenty of reports of people just walking along tracks because for maybe one of the first times, there were now dependable, smooth, level routes where there had never been any before. So the train absolutely needs them. But in terms of, going back to that concept of corporations negotiating with the community, this would be an example of communities, people making use of transportation infrastructure in ways that the corporations did not intend.
We'll get to that with risk.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So let's then the next step for that is commodification of travel. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, this is a concept that I've borrowed from a historian named Will McIntosh. And essentially, travel changed from something that you had to do yourself. You procure a horse. You plan out your own route. You ride the horse as far as you can. If the weather's bad, maybe you stop earlier than you wanted to. You have to find a place to stay overnight. This is before widespread hotels. So you are knocking on a stranger's door, hoping they will let you sleep on their porch and sell you a meal. And that was all standard. So people expected it, but nevertheless, you had to put it together yourself. What steam transit offers, both in steamboats and railroads, is that travel becomes something you purchase. All of those things that I mentioned before that you had to do yourself, the corporation is now going to do for you. They've established the routes. They've determined what times boats and trains are going to leave. You're going to have a seat. You're going to have a roof over your head. You know exactly where your destination is going to be and, you know, probably when you're going to get there. So travel changes from something that you have to assemble on your own and sort of manage all the risk yourself, and it becomes something where you just purchase, get a ticket, and the corporation takes care of it for you. So that's the commodification of travel.
They're providing hotels, they're providing restaurants eventually, or contracting with those who do all these things. And you might even get there when they say that you're going to get there, which, crazy enough, has never been the expectation. You get there when you get there in the past, because who knows what will happen to you. That's part of the adventure of travel. Travel is commodified. It becomes less of an adventure.
Yeah, less of an adventure, more regular, and it also opens it up to more people. So now if you can afford a ticket, you can go all these places that maybe you couldn't go before. And as we were talking about before with, you know, the speed of travel, and as these networks grow over the antebellum era, more and more potential destinations are opened up to people. So it does take away a little bit of the adventure, maybe takes away some of the risk. But it also opens it up to far more people and opens up more destinations to more people than had been the case before.
Sensory impact. There's been, gosh, this was like, was it 25 years ago when people started writing things about how early America sounded? The whole history of sensory impact has had quite a life since then. How were some of the ways that the steam power changed the sensory impact, the sensory world of antebellum America?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is one of those things where, as a historian, once you become attuned to these sorts of things, when you're reading primary sources, you realize that suddenly it's everywhere, that people are constantly talking about the different ways in which transit impacted their senses. And so one of them is, you mentioned how early America sounded. So, I mean, real obvious one is sound. So if you're a landowner, maybe for decades, all you've heard are the natural animals, you know, the birds that are around, the animals you own, your cattle or pigs making noise. Then suddenly someone comes to you and say, we'd like to put a railroad right next to your farm. You say, sure. And now you've got a whole nother range of sounds that you're hearing. The sound of the train itself, the whistle when it blows, animals maybe getting scared off by the train. They're making new noises. And so the soundscape of your world has been, you know, irrevocably affected by the introduction of the railroad. Sound was also a major marker for warning people about danger. Look out for the engine when the bell rings. That was a standard phrase that you would see on signs next to the railroad tracks at a grade crossing. And so people would know that as they come up to the crossing, they read the sign, realize, okay, I need to be paying attention with my ears. And that's what's going to tell me if a train is approaching. Another one of our senses is touch. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of descriptions of people writing about their railroad journey or riding on a steamboat and saying, you know, I'm being completely jostled around. I didn't get any sleep last night because of the motion. I'm going to have to stop writing because this is just wiggling too much. The people are very aware of how steam transit is impacting their body as they're on it. And it's something they comment about continuously. Even when the train or steamboat is not in motion, physical sensations, touch, gets a lot of commentary as, you know, these masses of people try to get onto a train, or there's a mad rush for the 15 minutes that are allotted for mealtime. Everybody rushing to get off and then rushing to get back on. People constantly mention the jostling, pushing, shoving that happened as people are packed onto steam transit. Mealtime alludes to another sense, that of taste. People would bring their own food with them. Local people along the route of a railroad would recognize that if a train stopped, that might be an opportunity to walk by the windows and try to sell food to people, some to the passengers. Some railroads themselves contracted with people to walk through the aisles and sell food to passengers. So taste was also another element of the travel experience. And then the one I'll close with is sight. Particularly for people riding on railroads, being able to take in the scenery was important. A lot of commentary about how fast things are moving, or appear to be moving as you look out the window. That would have been a new sensation to move at that level of speed and to see just how quickly things are passing by you, particularly up close next to you on the train. Guidebooks written for travelers during this time period would emphasize, you know, when you're traveling between these two towns, make sure you sit on the left-hand side of the train, because then you will have the best view of a mountain or a waterfall or a you know, a little village or what have you. And so people are taking in a lot of new information in new ways through all of their senses, and steam transit made that possible.
It's interesting that you know, Einstein's thought experiments about relativity feature trains.
Yes, yes.
But as you say, and as that quote from the House of the Seven Gables basis suggests, you could almost see Einstein in that quote from Hawthorne. People thinking about the ways in which motion is relative from being on a train from when you're outside a train. Italian futurists, they played around with art that looked like with the view from a train or from a airplane. But long before the Italian futurists, people have noticed the way that, you know, speed blurs things and speed alters the perceptions. This is around decades, almost a century, maybe 75 years prior to Einstein and Italian futurists. This is already part of the culture of steam power prior to the Civil War in America.
Yeah, people notice it right away. And I do want to emphasize, this is also something that just plain normal people notice as well. So this is a lot of the material that I'm using is coming from diaries, journals, letters written between friends. And so it's not just something that sort of the pundit class or scientists are aware of, but regular people are sort of grappling with this, amazed by it, impressed by it, and thinking about it right up as soon as it happens.
Let's finish up this this little gallop through the new experience of travel by talking about risk. You alluded to this in some of your first remarks. If you fall from a horse, you can kill yourself. But only one person can fall from one horse at a time, for the most part. The train wrecks and steamboat boiler explosions are truly horrendous events, and they can kill hundreds of people. So what's the perception of risk now, the risk-reward of travel in the era of steam power?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that you know, we all make assessments about risk. You know, here today, if I get in my car, I can get in an accident. If I get in an airplane, there could be an accident. But we sort of decide that it's worth it, or we blithely think that it won't happen to us. And I think the one way to look at it in the early time period is just to recognize that people, you know, the number of miles constructed, the number of passenger miles traveled over the antebellum period just continued to go up and up and up and up and up. And so for most people, whatever risk they were thinking about was worth the trade-off, particularly in the case of railroads. You know, railroads actually had a pretty good safety record for the first couple of decades. So just as you and I can recognize the difference between a fender bender and a major pileup on the interstate, people back then, I recognized that, okay, if an axle breaks, you know, maybe people get shook up and the trip is delayed for a couple of hours while they fix it, and then we get back on their way. That there's a difference between that and a major accident that kills, you know, many people. And major accidents with a lot of casualties were not, didn't happen as much until the 1850s, when the level of, when the volume of construction and the size of the network was now suddenly so great and so dense that time management alone was no longer sufficient to properly manage all the traffic that was happening. And so one of these assessments of risk was that the benefits were simply too good to pass up. You know, we've talked about all these things. More people could travel. They could travel to more destinations. They could do it more quickly. Steam transit opened all of this up. And so, absolutely, when accidents did happen, they could be horrific. They were also out of your control. If you fall off your horse, it's, you know, that may say something about your horse handling ability. Whereas when you get in a railroad or a steamboat, you're trusting the corporation's employees to sort of manage all of this for you. But for most people, that trade-off was worth it. I believe there's one travel guide that essentially recognized this at some point in the early 1850s and had a quotation, something like, a railroad car could be full of people reading a newspaper account of a horrific accident, but they're going to keep traveling on that railroad anyway. And so people were certainly aware, but they were willing to make those trade-offs for the benefits that steam transit brought.
Well, let me push that a little bit farther. One of the art I might use for this episode on our website is the race between the Robert E. Lee and the Natchez, which occurs in 1870, so it's completely out of the bounds of your book. But that was a very famous steamboat race up the Mississippi, 1,200 miles from New Orleans to St. Louis. That was carried on by one of the captains had a steamboat boiler blow up on him and kill 49 people in, in 1849, 86 people in 1849 when the boilers on his boat to Louisiana exploded at the New Orleans Wharf. One of the worst disasters of the Civil War was when a boiler blew, taking, was it prisoners of war back from the South up to Davenport, Iowa? I think hundreds of people died. But in 1870, people are still having a race, even though they know the dangers are immense. I mean, a lot of people die on boilers. So it's not just the convenience. There seems to be a change in calculation of risk. I mean, there are a lot of these Currier and Ives lithographs of the steamboat races indicating that there's something. This is as good as a racehorse. This is gripping stuff. And this is going on certainly before the Civil War.
Absolutely. I definitely came across cases of steamboat races. I think for me, that's a really good example of when you choose to travel on a steamboat, you are sort of ceding control to the captain. And if the captain decides that he wants to race, then he's bringing everybody else along, whether they want to do that or not. And I think you're right that the risk calculus had to involve those sorts of things for passengers because they would have known it was a possibility. And they, as you say, there are images of it. They can read about it. They know it's a possibility. But the, when you look at the statistics in terms of, you know, passenger travel, they don't go down. And so I think the, for, I don't know how much I can get into the psychology of this, but certainly people looked at the risk and the reward of being able to travel this way. And if a, you know, 20-day journey is suddenly cut down to 3 days because you can take a steamboat on the Ohio River to wherever you're going, I think for many people, they were willing to board and either hope that nothing would happen to them or know that most of these journeys were safe. And so they would probably be okay. But again, you know, I think we make similar calculations all the time when we travel. And we have to, I mean, I certainly read about car accidents. I live on a busy intersection, so I've seen car accidents, but I also get in my car every day to drive to work. So I don't know if that's a positive development or not, but we seem to have made that trade-off.
We're recording right after the death of Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist who really launched behavioral economics. And one of his key insights was the human inability to properly assess risk. We get very excited about airplane disasters, even as they are vanishingly small. And we get into our cars all the time, even as, you know, more people die every year than died in any year of the Vietnam War. Gosh, probably even World War II. I don't know. At least American soldiers. Who knows? An amazing number of people die every year in car accidents, and we think nothing of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what was so striking to me about that guidebook that I paraphrased earlier is that, I mean, back in that time period, they knew this was happening. They knew that everybody could read about a railroad accident, and but they were still going to get on the train anyway, assuming the odds were in their favor. And in fairness, you know, they, I think they were, again, you know, sort of major mass death accidents on railroads were, you know, relatively far and few between until the 1850s. There's a great book on this, Death Rode the Rails by Mark Aldrich, who, I mean, he covers way more about accidents than I do, if that's a topic that's of interest to your listeners. But I think, you know, for the most part, people were okay doing it, and they were rewarded for that because, by and large, people survived their journeys.
Well, let's move on to some of those guidebooks. You write, steam transit occupied mental space for Americans as well as physical space. So let's talk about briefly about the arts, the high culture, as some have called it, music and travel guides. Briefly, how was music influenced by steam power and steam transit?
Yeah, looking at music, I found sort of two primary ways that steam transit entered into that cultural conversation. One was that music was composed in honor or celebration of a railroad or a steamboat, particularly around the when something was about to be dedicated. So I think there are four different pieces of music that were written to commemorate the start of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. So this is something that happens very early on, right away, and continues throughout the Antebellum era, is that composers are inspired by the creation of a railroad line or the launch of a steamboat to write a piece of music to commemorate it. So a commemorative aspect is the first. The second is that some composers actually tried to incorporate the sound of steam transit into their composition. And unfortunately, most of what we have here are written descriptions of what the music sounded like, not the actual recorded performance itself. So we're relying a little bit on the record that's been left to us. But it's clear that there are some composers who tried to imitate steam transit, the whistle, the sort of churning of the wheels as it gets started, and at least one case, sort of concluding the piece with sort of a grand cacophony indicating the train coming to a stop. And I was able to track one piece of music through newspapers for a couple of years, demonstrating that this was a relatively popular performance by at least one traveling orchestra. And so that's music. One, it's sort of commemorative. And then second, composers did try to imitate or incorporate the sounds of steam transit into their compositions.
And guidebooks are a response. They become a sort of cultural output related to that commodification of travel, I guess, that we've been talking about.
Yeah, earlier. Absolutely. If a railroad line wanted customers, one way to do that is to let people know what they're going to see and what they're going to expect if they get on a railroad. And so these guidebooks have a couple of different functions. One is sort of relatively straightforward. You know, this is when the train leaves. This is the time that it arrives at these different places. And here's the mileage traveled and so on and so forth. But I think what's more interesting for our purposes is the level of description that you find about the countryside, about the sights that you can see. As I mentioned earlier, you know, make sure you're sitting on this side of the train at this mile marker so that you can get a glimpse of some particular interesting point. And so what this means is that people who never travel on this route have the opportunity to sort of virtually experience what people on the train would experience because they can read about it and sort of visualize for themselves what they would see on the journey. Or many times these travel guides are just chock full of illustrations. And so, you know, thinking back to the quotation you said at the top of this conversation from Sally McNeil, she had read and heard so much. This is one example of cultural output that makes it easy for Americans who are nowhere near the transportation networks to still experience and think about and participate in these technological changes because they can read about them in such a detailed and evocative way.
I guess the very exact analogy would be that for about 20 years until deregulation, jet travel was a cultural artifact. You could read about it. You could see it in all the glamorous advertisements and magazines, but people just couldn't afford to fly overseas on a Boeing 747 or 707. But nonetheless, it was a part of the cultural output around them and the milieu around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And these, I think that's what's so fascinating to me is that these guidebooks, you know, if all that mattered were their practical effects, you know, here's where you get on, here's how long it's going to take. It just needs to be a single sheet of paper. But these are 150, 200 page guidebooks writing in sort of loving detail about the route and everything you're going to see and everything that's available. And so clearly there's a lot more going on here than just getting from A to B.
Well, we've talked about mental space, physical space, and mental space, and now let's talk about sacred space. You have an interesting chapter, and it leads me to this question. Is steam power Protestant?
That is a great question. What I will say is, all of the sources that I was able to uncover talking about religion and steam were from Protestant writers. And so I hesitate to make a blanket judgment because there may have been something that I missed or sources that I just wasn't aware of that would sort of contradict that. And so what I tried to do was to be pretty careful about laying out that while all my sources were Protestant, I don't know that I can say that there was no interest outside of Protestantism or anything like that. What I can say, based on the sources, is that for those writers, steam power was something that they were more than happy to adopt because it allowed them to spread the gospel. And so if American corporations are going to set up these networks and new ways to distribute information, then there were a large number of religious thinkers who thought that they needed to be a part of that, that this was an important way for them to spread their own message. At the same time, there were significant worries in the same religious community. First, that steam-powered transit would help people break the Sabbath. And so if you travel on a Sunday, then that's not something that these writers think you should be doing. And second of all, this sort of concentration on wealth and growth and the pursuit of sort of material goods was distracting people from the more important growth in their religious and spiritual life. And so for many of these writers, accidents and the death that would come at a major accident was a reminder that for all the work that mankind and humankind has done to create these incredible machines and develop these new networks, for these writers, accidents were a sign of God's continued power in the world, that we as humans shouldn't get too cocky or self-assured about our abilities, because we can still be struck down at any moment.
I'm just curious, as I was reading this, they aren't particularly deep reflections by these Protestant divines, but I've been reading a little Marshall McLuhan lately. And as I was reading your book, I come across this passage from McLuhan. And I'm going to just change one word. I'm going to change media to technology and just let's play this forward. McLuhan writes, "Our conventional response to all technology, namely that it is how they are used that counts, is the numb stance of the technological idiot. For the content of a medium or the content of a technology is like the juicy piece of meat carried by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind." That's him getting across his point that the medium is the message. There's no tension, at least in that you seem to have uncovered, of anyone thinking about steam power as a mediating force or how steam power changes society other than sort of Sabbatarianism.
Yeah, I think there is that sort of broader point about getting sucked into the pursuit of wealth and the pursuit of material things. Sabbatarianism is a big one. And of course, that's part of a broader movement during the exact same time, thinking about, should the mail be delivered on Sunday and that sort of thing. So that's an existing conversation within the religious community. But I do think that for a lot of the writers that I uncovered, they were perfectly happy to adopt steam transit if that helped them accomplish their ends, whether that's, you know, widening the distribution of publications, or again, as an example of unintended consequences, how a corporation sets up to do one thing, but then the users of a technology come up with another meaning, you know, using the infrastructure. So I know there was I think it was Iowa City, Iowa, where there was no, at a time that there was no church building that a group could use, they used a railroad car. There were certainly people who noticed the similarity of the design of an American railroad car, an aisle, you know, with alternating sets of seats on either side, the similarity of that to a church with an aisle down the center and pews on the side. And so, yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, the writers that I was able to uncover were more than happy to use the technology for their own ends, for spreading the message of the gospel as they saw it. But there was also definitely a concern about what impact it was going to have on American life with that pursuit of wealth and material gain, distracting people from spiritual needs.
Okay, we have to start winding this up, but there's probably one of the most important, to my mind, parts of the book is the way in which railroads begin to change the idea of what culture is broadly understood for people, not in the cultural outputs or artifacts like guidebooks, but in the very essential question of something that they haven't really had to think about before, which is a railroad car public or private? And this is something that you trace throughout the book, and it's just absolutely fascinating. It means different things for conversations. Is this conversation now private between us, or is it public? It means different things for blacks. It means different things for women. It means different things for children. All these things are you ring the changes on this theme throughout the book. So briefly, if I'm having a conversation with someone on the railroad car, is it a public or a private conversation?
Well, I would encourage you to treat it as a public conversation because anyone around you can hear. I was truly stunned when I was doing this research about the sorts of things that people would talk about on trains and on steamboats. They would strike up conversations with total strangers on some of the hottest and most sort of the hottest topics of the day, you know, up to and including slavery. It is, I guess we all have different travel experiences, but it is inconceivable to me that someone would stand up on an airplane today and say, you know, let's talk about this political topic as a big group. But there are certainly back then plenty of examples of people debating slavery, talking about all kinds of issues with strangers in public. And so I think for conversations, there were definitely people always listening and willing to talk to total strangers about difficult topics.
We should probably get to I want to get to probably blacks last, because there's also something you allude to on page 133 about your previous book, Railroads in the Old South, and I want to finish with that. But the women, the role of women in society, I think we can say that it dramatically begins to change because of the railroad.
Yeah, it's... steam transit offers a lot of new possibilities for women travelers, and there's a lot in the etiquette literature on this. There are a lot of fathers writing to daughters and wives on this topic, and women writing in their own journals on this topic. And the question as to whether or not women should travel alone was something that was discussed a great deal. This is one of those topics where it's sort of impossible to have a statistical sense of what happened. I mean, we'll probably never know what percentage of women only traveled with a chaperone or what percentage traveled alone. But what we, I think what we can say from the available evidence is that regardless of what decision each individual woman made, it was something that was weighed very carefully and something that they were definitely thinking about. And so for some women, steam transit opened up a new possibility to travel out on their own and something that they became comfortable with. For others, you know, traveling with a chaperone was important. But either way, it's something they had to think about and a serious decision that they took seriously.
And because it's, again, it's, we're in a very nebulous zone on steamboats and trains of whether you're in a private space, a domestic space, or whether you're in a public space.
Yeah, and there are, I mean, there are certainly some examples of railroads and probably more so steamboats that created separate spaces for ladies. And they were very purposefully equipped to look domestic, sort of, you know, upholstered, nice upholstered seats, like you would find in your parlor at home and that sort of thing. But doing that is expensive. And so I wouldn't want people to think that that was sort of de rigueur across all transportation during the era. But it was an option for women to have completely segregated separate spaces on steam transit. But when that wasn't an option, then women still had to negotiate that same sort of set of questions about how and under what circumstances they would travel.
Finally, children on steam transit and steamboats and trains. I never would have thought of children in this context. Where do children fit in this public or private question?
Yeah, children were very interesting for me because I wanted to try to take a look at a group of people who sort of grew up with this transition. So for a lot of people, steam transit was something new. But if you're born in 1830, then it's the world you know. It's always been a part of your experience. Much of the literature that I was able to uncover on children, unfortunately, is not directly about their travel experience, just because we don't have a lot of journals or writings from children. But there is a lot of material on how adults used steam transit to teach lessons to children. You know, like in a work of fiction, a young boy going on a journey by himself can be an example for the child who's reading about how they can also be brave in their own lives and also how they should behave. And so to your public-private question, watching children, teaching children rather, that the conductor on a train is someone they can trust. It's a position of authority, so they should feel free to go up and ask a question if they have one. Readers could see that and then think about how to apply those lessons in their own lives.
I guess the importance there is that it's a person in authority whose name they don't know.
Yeah.
Whose family they don't know. It's just, it is a position, even if you're far away from home, whatever the name of that person is, they're a position of authority who's trustworthy.
Yeah, it's someone who's a complete stranger, but you can walk up to them mm-hmm. and trust them because of the position that they hold. Absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. It's a revolutionary new idea. That's not something that was ever have been a problem in the
right,
past.
Right.
That would have to be solved. Let's finish up with this question of black mobility. You very persuasively, to my mind, argue that steam power reveals something key to the nature of slavery, of antebellum American slavery. What is that thing that it reveals?
Yeah, I mean, one of the fascinating things for me was that in the antebellum South, enslaved labor was used to construct transit networks. So enslaved people were used to lay down railroads. They were used to, you know, build cars, repair them. They were part of the operation of trains. And so at the same time, enslaved labor is constructing these networks, but also those are networks that then other enslaved people could use to try to escape their enslavement. So the whites in the American South very much wanted to be a part of this major technological change and make use of the most modern technology available. But they also wanted to hold on to their retrograde labor regime. And so on the one hand, they have an interest in building out this transportation network. But on the other hand, that same transportation network helps enslaved people escape. And we know this happened because we can read about it in newspapers, you know, largely that were published in the North, but also some stories in Southern newspapers printed something as a warning. And what's intriguing about this, or one of the things that's intriguing about this to me, is that this demonstrates how dependent slavery was on local knowledge. So if an enslaved person tries to run away from the plantation, they might see someone that they know on the road, and that person could say, "Hey, aren't you, you're not supposed to be here. You know, get out of here." But the farther away you get, the fewer people know who you are. And so steam transit offered an opportunity that was clearly enticing to get people away from where they were known locally as quickly as possible, as quickly as steam would take them. Now, I don't want to over-exaggerate here. I mean, it was still incredibly risky to try to escape. And so I don't want to give your listeners the sense that there are like thousands and thousands and thousands of people trying this every week. But it was definitely, there's no question that the networks in the South were used by enslaved people to escape. And that demonstrates how dependent slavery was on local knowledge.
Should say before I move on, the most famous escape is Frederick Douglass's. He just dresses as a sailor and then takes the train to Philadelphia from Baltimore. But there are many. That's the most famous escape by railroad. And as you point out, and I had a duh moment. The whole metaphor of underground railroad is one of those cultural metaphors produced by steam transit, which is then appropriated to something. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to think it was an actual like buried railroad that somehow people were using to get out of slavery. But that isn't the case. It was just a metaphor. It's a really important metaphor. It says something to enslaved people in the South about regularity and hope and speed and things like that.
Yeah, the Douglass story is marvelous because he writes that the papers that he had with him described someone else who didn't look like him at all. And so when he shows that to the conductor, there's a tremendous amount of power in that conductor's hands in that moment. And that's because he's the one who's actually making the judgment. Do these papers match with this person? And so that's what I mean by local knowledge. If that conductor had known Frederick Douglass through some other means or because they were both members of the same community, then he would have known right away the papers are falsified. But as Douglass got further away, that local knowledge evaporates. And so the conductor looks at it, decides it's okay, and lets Douglass, and Douglass continues with his escape. And the other point you make there, absolutely correct, you know, Underground Railroad did have some really important above ground aspects to it. And certainly as rail networks get built out in the northern states, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Pennsylvania, that really enable people, once they get across the Ohio River, they can start moving north much more quickly. And there's a marvelous book about this by a historian named Robert Churchill, who's written a lot about how railroads get used in the northern part of this journey. And essentially, as railroad networks get built out, people who were organizing these escapes in the north made less use of clandestine means for getting people around. They could just start buying train tickets, put people on trains, and get them up to Canada. So it really did have an extraordinary impact for the people who were fortunate enough to be able to take advantage of it.
So friend of the podcast, Michael Conley, wrote a book, I think came out in 2003, about capitalism, politics, and railroads in Jacksonian New England. And one of Michael's the burr in his bonnet at the time was the way that Whigs, the utopian technological vision of the Whigs, the railroad solved for the Whigs in New England the problem of how do you govern a great republic. This is the problem the Federalists were confronting. And as they were looking back at Montesquieu, who said, yeah, republics are fine, but they can only be small. Madison had played around with the idea and Federalists, but finally the railroad's the technological solution. Railroad and the telegraph, of course. That will unite the republic and make it self-governing. And then, of course, the railroad is really successful at taking soldiers to the front during the Civil War. Nonetheless, you seem to, as you say, the experience of steam transit was not unifying, but if the lack of unity was a cost, the blossoming of reactions to steam chronicled in these pages was surely a benefit. There might not have been a unified political culture that the Whigs dreamed of across the antebellum United States. Far from that. But there was certainly some kind of unity in a perception that is really quite extraordinary. Could we end by just reflecting on that?
For me, this is a really good example of how a common experience is not necessarily a unifying one. And so a lot of people all over the country, I don't know if we, you did say it, Sally McNeil is in Texas, right? So at that point in 1860, that's a pretty remote corner of the United States. And so
Brazoria County. I mean, is that near Dallas? I mean, I suspect it's still a remote corner of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. And yet she can still be a part of this larger conversation. So it's common, but it's not unifying. Mm-hmm. And you see this constantly throughout the antebellum era. People talking about bonds of iron, or like, this is going to tie the country together. It obviously did not work in that sense, because my book ends with the Civil War. But I do think that there was a lot of tremendous cultural ferment around these developments. And so if we just look at it as a failure because the United States ended up breaking up briefly there in the Civil War, first of all, I don't think that's something that railroads and steamboats were ever truly designed to do. I think there was a lot of rhetoric about unification that was applied that sort of sounds good when you're trying to get something constructed. But that I doubt that was ever their true purpose. But more importantly, for what I've been looking at here, is that there was clearly just a ton of interest by ordinary Americans, and that interest gets expressed in a lot of different ways. Obviously, they ride the steamboat, they ride the railroad, but then there's all this music and poetry and writing and metaphor and jokes and sermons and all kinds of things, cartoons, images, all coming out around steam transit. And so for me, that's something that's really important for us to understand and get a hold of, because it was important to the people back then. And so if we're going to truly understand how they grappled with technological change, we need to understand all of this, not just the aspects of construction and the financing of it.
My guest today has been Aaron W. Mars. He's the author of The American Transportation Revolution, A Social and Cultural History. Aaron, thank you so much for being part of Historically Thinking.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a delightful conversation, and I'm really gratified for your interest in my work. Thank you so much.
And thanks so much to you as well for being part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, you can, of course, give us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. But by far the best way of helping us out is to share the podcast with a friend or with many friends. George McDonough is our producer. John Rutta is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambone, and I'll be back with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.